Welcome to the Casting Across Fly Fishing Podcast. I'm Matthew of castingacross.com, where I explore the quarry and culture of fly fishing. This is the 188th episode of the podcast, and today we're going to be talking about natural disasters, specifically flooding, national parks, and how fly fishers have to deal with it, and more importantly, think about it. But before we get to that, I did want to mention that we are 2 weeks away from another Accusations podcast. Every 10 episodes, I take reader and listener feedback, whether it be through emails or social media chirps, and I interact with those things. And so if you have a question about something that you've heard or just have about fly fishing in general, a comment about something that you've noticed in the fly fishing culture or something that you've read on the website, or if you have an accusation, you want to take me to task for something, and I have a feeling that there's a chance that something that gets mentioned in this podcast may very well elicit a comment like that, then send it my way. And I always interact with three or four comments that come in leading up to the Accusation podcast every 10 episodes. They're always fun. It's always like a little grab bag. Instead of one topic that spans 20 minutes, it's like three or four topics that spans 20 minutes. So it's a fast-moving podcast. One more thing before we get to the subject matter of today's episode, and that is thank you for reviews and ratings on iTunes. I appreciate it. As I mentioned before, still not 100% sure how it works, but I know it's a good thing. So if you have a minute, if you are using your phone or your computer or your tablet to access this podcast and you're utilizing iTunes, if you scroll down and tap on those stars, 5 would be great. I would appreciate that. Then that would be helpful for me and for the podcast. In 1980, on the morning of May 18th, after weeks and weeks of small tremors, a 5.1 magnitude earthquake shook Mount St. Helens, and that triggered the largest, most recent volcanic eruption in North America. And what happened, and what is significant for today's podcast, is that the surrounding area, a beautiful part of the Pacific Northwest, was covered in ash and debris and fire, and things were significantly altered. The mud flows, the hot gas, the scorched forests, all those things spread out for miles and miles around, significantly impacting the woods, the land itself, and the water. And for a fly fishing podcast, when we think about water, we're thinking about fish. And for certainly months and even years after the Mount St. Helens incident, there were waters that looked essentially barren. You can hear people talk about it looking like a moonscape. But something interesting happened. By 1990, fish were detected in Spirit Lake. Now, if you have an opportunity, Google Spirit Lake in relation to Mount St. Helens. This lake's elevation was raised over 200 feet immediately following the eruption of Mount St. Helens because the amount of debris and effectively the side of the mountain falling into the lake. It was completely devoid of life. Within 10 years, there were rainbow trout that were found in the water. And not only are there rainbow trout in the water today, but they grow at a remarkably quick pace. Now, Spirit Lake is closed to fishing because they're utilizing it as a living laboratory to analyze and assess the impact of not just volcanic eruptions, but significant ecological disturbances on ecosystems. And so you can't go there and catch these giant volcano trout, but they're there. And I think that shows something very remarkable about nature and how nature and the natural world, whether it be something living like a fish or a macroinvertebrate insect or a mammal, is or even just the landscape around it, has been hardwired to be incredibly resilient. I mean, you have a lake that was completely changed. It was effectively wiped off the face of the map, brought back on as something different and lifeless, and within a decade, it was showing signs of life. And here we are, given it's over 40 years later, but 40 years is not a lot in the grand scheme of things of the world, and certainly after a volcanic eruption. And you have fish, big fish swimming in it. the rainbow trout again being probably one of the most prominent ones. So why are we talking about Mount St. Helens? Is there a volcanic eruption that's happening any day now? Maybe, I don't know. But we are, as this is being recorded, the middle of June in 2022, we are witnessing significant dramatic flooding happening in Yellowstone. Why do I bring Mount St. Helens up? It's not to say, get over it in 10 years, certainly in 40 years, everything is going to be okay. Because I don't know that. Nobody knows that. But the long track record of our observances of the natural world is that things get back to normal. So, real quick, what's going on in Yellowstone? And why Yellowstone? Why of all of the all of the ecological disasters, of all the floods, of all the things that we could be talking about, why focus on this one? I think it's because the United States has a very fond relationship with Yellowstone National Park. Yellowstone, although not the first national park, is kind of like our most famous national park. It gets a remarkable amount of tourism. It is kind of the highlight of the West. It has a variety of ecosystems, and for fly fishers, it is a hot spot. It is a place that is just typifies Western fly fishing and wild Western fly fishing. So to see the imagery that's online, see the imagery that comes across on your phone, see what's coming across the evening news, it is upsetting. It is disturbing because it takes these picturesque, beautiful, meandering rivers and they've turned into muddy, overflowing torrents that are tearing roads and banks and houses from their foundations as it makes its way downstream. So it is dramatic and it is disturbing for the natural ecological impact that's having, but also for the impact it's having on people. And you can't diminish either of those. They both matter. So I was reading a number of articles on this, and this is where, like I said, I thought I might give it a little bit of blowback. But an article that is in the New York Times, and there's so many articles that are out there, and honestly, I haven't been reading a lot of things because very quickly it goes from what's happening. It gives like 5% of the article on what's happening, and then 95% of the article is like why global warming is the reason for all this. Now, I'm not questioning that in the context of what I'm talking about right now. I'm just saying I want to know what's happening. I want to know what the cubic foot per second is. I want to know the economic impact that's had. I want to know the stories of the people who are on the ground. I get it. The prevailing thought and notion is that this has some sort of connection to a changing climate. I get it. I think we all get that. No matter how we feel about that, no matter how we interpret the science, no matter any of those things, we know that is the narrative. Okay? But that's why I haven't been reading a lot of these articles because whether I agree with it or not, it's kind of frustrating to not get more details than that. So social media has actually been much more beneficial because you get to hear people's stories, people who are at Yellowstone, people who are actually watching this happen, and they're telling about their experience. So anyway, back to this New York Times articles. Here's a quote from it. It says, "It is difficult to directly connect the damage in Yellowstone to a rapidly warming climate. Rivers have flooded for millennium, but scientists are raising the alarm that in the coming years, destruction related to climate change will reach nearly all 423 national parks, which are particularly vulnerable to rising temperatures. The litany of threats read like a biblical reckoning: fire and flood, melting ice sheets, rising seas, and heat waves." There's a little bit of irony in that last few statements, but that's not what I'm going to focus on right now. But notice that the beginning of that statement, it's difficult to directly connect the damage in Yellowstone to a rapidly warming climate. Rivers have flooded for millennia. It then directly shifts to, but it is because of climate change. And then the statement that national parks are more susceptible to rising climates, as if climate change is somehow aware of the borders that have been arbitrarily placed by the Department of the Interior. Now, if someone much smarter than me can let me know how that works, then please do let me know. I anticipate and I imagine what they mean by that is that areas that have been less developed have a greater biodiversity, are more protected, are also more fragile. And so if there is any sort of climate change or alternating heat cycles or cooling cycles that are more dramatic than they were in the past, that these areas may be more susceptible to damage. I assume that's what they're saying, but the way that it's stated here in a couple other places I saw are a little bit misleading, almost as if like there's some sort of boundary based detriment that comes to a national park because it's a national park, that like that's where the angry global warming is going to come. Like Al Gore painted these, didn't forgot to paint the blood over the doorpost for the national parks. But anyway, what that article says though, I think is important for us to understand. I'm again not debating, questioning, dealing with really the issue of climate change. But the fact that it says it's difficult to directly connect the damage in Yellowstone to a rapidly warming climate, rivers have flooded for a millennium, needs to be in our heads. And as we have an emotional response to seeing these images, it needs to be in our hearts. Because I can think of some of the rivers that I have loved fishing for the last 20 years, that if I read books that were published in the 90s, they talk about how these rivers were scoured out by ridiculous flooding from hurricanes or from other major flood events in sometime in the last couple of generations. I'm thinking of rivers in Pennsylvania that, because of impoundments and their failure, had huge flood events. I'm thinking of rivers in the Shenandoah that, because of hurricanes and the amount of water that came through, their courses were completely changed. Very recently, I was in a river or a stream in Vermont, completely different location than it was just 15 years ago, but there are trout in it and they are thriving. And the reason is that the natural world is incredibly elastic. Now, it's interesting. We kind of vacillate on these things. And as we think about our natural world and how we relate to it, we have to remember that things like floods and things like wildfires are actually helpful and beneficial in some ways. They have regenerative effects. It wasn't that long ago that we tried to prevent wildfires with every fiber of our being. And then we realized that by preventing them, that when they did happen, because we cannot control it, that when they do happen, they are significantly more perilous, not just for human life, but also for the natural world, because they burn faster and hotter and longer than if we allow them to happen on their own. It's just difficult for us to wrap our mind around the fact that things are supposed to die, things are supposed to break for things to continue and be perpetuated. That's the way the world works now. And that's difficult for us. And so we try to stop it. We try to hem things in. We build corridors. We straighten and channelize rivers. We put out every tiny little forest fire. And then when something bad happens, then it looks even worse. I think one of the more dramatic images that we see in Yellowstone right now is as these rivers are raging and they are fast eroding along their banks, how these roads are plummeting by huge car-sized chunks into the rivers, and then the road itself is being swept away. Well, that makes sense. That is exactly what's going to happen if you build a road and all of the engineering that goes into building a safe, secure, level road immediately adjacent to a river. That's precisely what's going to happen, because you have this barrier that is going to be eroded, and the whole point of the barrier is to be not just load-bearing, but to channelize and control the river. And so when as soon as the first chink in the armor is detected, that's when things begin to fall apart. Not even 5 years before the eruption at Mount St. Helens, the Big Thompson River, which flows out of Rocky Mountain National Park, or Estes Park, which is just to the east of Rocky Mountain National Park, down through Loveland, Colorado, it flooded. There was great loss of life. And again, the road got completely swept away. Now, this is very different than what you see in Yellowstone. This is a very steep mountain canyon with a river moving at a pretty good gradient down the entire way. It's a remarkable drive. It's a lot of fun. But back in 1976, when this thing flooded because of just too much rain and some engineering issues that they had up in the impoundment up in Estes Park, it led to a loss of life It led to massive destruction of property, and it led to the river being just completely blown out. But guess what? I've caught fish in the Big Thompson River. This was probably in the early part of the 21st century. So we're talking about 25 years later after this happened. So again, this kind of gets back to the fact that we see these things, we lament the fact that there is destruction and damage and pain. We certainly lament the loss of human life. We can even lament the loss of animal life. I think it's even appropriate to lament the fact that non-sentient life, plants and just the ecosystem as a whole is destroyed. I think there's nothing wrong with that. To say something that was once beautiful is now not beautiful is okay. But we have to appreciate how quickly life rebounds when it comes to plants and animals and fish and ecosystems. We can continue to mourn the loss of human life, but those other things, they come back, and they come back so quickly. Now, here's where you may insert the caveat, and you say, well, it's not going to be able to come back at all if climate change continues. And here's where I'm going to push back on that a little bit. If you have a worldview and you have a way of looking at everything that is bound up in an evolutionary model, whether it be Darwinism or some sort of neo-Darwinism or something completely different than that, then the species that would be now habitating in the ecosystems that had changed, what's wrong with that? What's the problem there? What's the moral judgment that you can make on, well, this fish is gone and this fish is here? Why is the fish that's gone have any more right to be there than the fish that is now there, or the toad or the bird or something like that? Just again, I'm not making any sort of judgment call or anything like that, but just from that worldview, as an ecosystem changes, what's the problem? You know, what's wrong with that? It's great that there are, you know, fish that are moving their way up the coast more now than they did before because of warming, ocean temperatures. Why not? You say, well, because we're doing it. Okay, but if things are elastic and things are able to change, then morally, what's wrong with that? So I am not advocating pollution. I'm not advocating practices that would cause or would lead to climate change. I'm just saying that the onus is on the person who's saying it's morally wrong for these animals to be where they once were not, to have to reckon with the fact that they're making a moral statement about something like that. So, okay, that might have been a big kind of, you know, right turn off of what we're talking about. But these are things that are worth thinking about, particularly as you get fired up. You know, does it help to get fired up on Facebook and leave comments decrying practices of the Department of the Interior or energy companies or, you know, a particular political party? Does that help? Or does it help to maybe buy some flies from a fly shop in Gardner, Montana, online, just to give them a little bit of support, buy a hat, buy a sticker, buy a t-shirt? Does it help to make plans to volunteer in some way, in some sort of cleanup effort, if you happen to live in Wyoming, Montana, or something like that? Does it help to maybe go patronize a national park by you, because in some way, shape, or form, that money will make its way to the works that are inevitably going to be undertaken by the rangers and everyone else out in Yellowstone as the cleanup efforts continue? My thought is that's probably a lot more valuable than getting in a huff about things and not doing anything about it. But also know that the fish are going to come back. The fish will be there. If there are fish in Spirit Lake at the foot of Mount St. Helens, if there are fish swimming in the Big Thompson River, there's going to be fish in Yellowstone. And the way that our media cycle works, you're not going to be thinking about the Yellowstone River next year. If you don't live in that valley, if you don't have property or a business or you were directly impacted, not directly impacted because your feelings got hurt because you saw pictures, but you weren't there, then you're not going to be thinking about this next year. Because think about the floods that happened last season. Can you name them? Can you think about them? Can you think about the where the red tides happen and where all of the, you know, just when was the last time you thought about what's happened in the Everglades? It's not in the news cycle right now. And I'm not saying that that is to our detriment, or I'm not saying that is some sort of character flaw. It's just human nature. We move on to the next thing. And part of that is because things are elastic. Things are able to be rejuvenated. That's the way that things have been created. And we should be thankful for that. We should appreciate that. And so, how can you channel those feelings? Feelings that are relatively fickle, feelings that are kind of vapid in the sense that you're not going to be angry about the Yellowstone River floods in June of 2023. I'll put money on that. So how can you channel those things today, knowing that they're not going to be gone, or they're not going to be around, I should say, in a matter of months, or certainly in a matter of years? How can you channel them to be more helpful, more beneficial? So that's why I'd say buy a hat or a shirt from a fly shop that's in the Yellowstone area. Volunteer if you're close by. Visit a national park close to you, and be a responsible environmental steward, and be well read. Read things, point things out, like I read in that Yellowstone flood article in the New York Times, which are almost contradictory and really based more on feelings than they are on hard science. And even if they are right, the way they're worded is a little bit misleading, and you know, kind of is charged to get people maybe moving. That's the optimistic way to look at it, or maybe just get people in a huff, and that's the pessimistic way to look at it. But let me know what you think. Matthew@castingacross.com. Again, the purpose of this podcast was not to make any sort of statement on any sort of ecological crisis or you know, prevailing theories or data on anything related to these issues. The point of this is, how do we think about these things? Are we driven by winds of media narrative? Or are we driven by scientific research? Or are we driven by looking at things from a historical perspective and realizing that there's productive and unproductive ways to channel our energies and efforts? This week on castingacross.com, two articles. The first one is called PULSA, Every Man's Strike Indicator. PULSA, Every Man's Strike Indicator. Do you like PULSAs? I like PULSAs. What's a PULSA? A PULSA is a little foam strike indicator. It looks like a figure eight. It has adhesive on the inside. You pinch it on top of your fly leader or tippet, and it is a brightly colored little strike indicator. They're disposable, which, you know, some people might not like, but they work really well and they're very subtle. They are not particularly wind resistant, which makes the casting relatively easy in comparison to some bigger, bulkier strike indicators. But they're great. They serve a purpose. They are part of an armada of different strike indicators that I carry with me all the time. So I talk about five different things that I have learned about using pulses for, you know, 25 years. Nothing's remarkable, nothing's revolutionary. But if you use them, maybe you one of those things will be new to you. If you don't use them, maybe this will show you the reasons or some of the reasons why you should consider carrying this, you know, $2.50 sleeve of strike indicators with the thingamabobbers and the French indicators and other things that you happen to use on a regular basis. Wednesday's article was called Trout and Fire in the Tundra, Part 2. This is a continuing narrative of fly fishing adventures and camping hijinks from, goodness, this must be 25 years ago. So I'm continuing to tell this story, and you can find the first part of the series through a link on Trout and Fire on the Tundra Part 2, which will take you to Trout and Fire on the Part. Tundra Part 1, or you can just find that on the website yourself. This week on the podcast, I'm going to recommend Old Town Canoes. Old Town Canoes are in Old Town, Maine, which is up there. And I know it's up there because I drove up there last week because I picked up my brand new canoe, the Discovery 133 in green, and I'm excited to use it this season for fishing and exploring, and then this fall for duck hunting. It's an awesome little boat. I'll talk more about it inevitably in the coming weeks as I get a little bit more use out of it. And I'm just excited for you to also hear about my boys' experience with it here in a few weeks when they're on the podcast. But Old Town is an awesome little place. I only spent about an hour there up in Maine, but it is like, you know how in Raiders of the Lost Ark, when they put the ark away in that big warehouse and then they start backing out and you see all the different crates of everything that's in the warehouse? It's like that, only with canoes and kayaks. It's amazing. It's just like a really cool thing to see all these things it lined up, and it's the smell is also really cool too. So you know, you're talking about molded plastic. When I was a child, I would go to the Brookfield Zoo in Chicago, and they had these machines. I think they're called moldoramas. They used to be all over the place. There's only a few places in the country where they still use them, but you put like a quarter in, and it would injection mold using hot plastic an animal, and then it would cool for a second and then drop out. And the smell of that injection molded plastic from my childhood is exactly what I thought of when I walked into the Old Town factory, which that is no reason to buy or not buy a kayak. But awesome American company, so many cool things. They have great partnerships with their parent brand, Johnson Outdoors, so Minn Kota, Humminbird. So they are coming out with some really cool new things that I talked a little bit about in an article that came out a few months ago talking about kayaks and canoes and their uses in fly fishing. But if you're looking for a canoe or kayak, definitely check out Old Town. They're not the cheapest, but they are some of the best. And you'll hear that from people who have been using all sorts of canoes and kayaks for generations. And you're hearing that from me for a relatively new canoe and kayak user. But if you want to check them out, I'll put a link to Johnson Outdoors' parent website as well as Old Town Canoe on the show notes for this podcast page over at castingacross.com. Thanks for listening to the Casting Across Fly Fishing Podcast. Please subscribe in your favorite podcast app and rate the podcast on iTunes. Then head over to castingacross.com for 3 posts a week on the people, places, and things that go into the pursuit of fish.